Welcome to Central Coast Voices, a program addressing the ramifications of change in our communities and beyond, and how today's choices will impact tomorrow's community. This program is a combined project of KCBX and our team of program hosts. Today on Central Coast Voices, host Fred Monroe and his guests from Azure Printed Homes and Welcome Home Village will share with us how small houses made from 150,000 recycled plastic bottles each, and in just two-thirds of the time of conventional building, will break the cycle of homelessness for a significant number of people currently living outside along the Bob Jones Trail. We invite you to listen, learn, and participate in our conversation today. We are able to take your phone calls live today at 805-781-3875. And with that, let's join Fred Monroe and his guests. Over to you, Fred.
Thank you, Brad. Glad to be with you today. Innovations in housing development methods, along with community efforts, seem to create and maintain supportive housing, is not necessarily new to us, or not new to the world, but somewhat new to the Central Coast. This has become, when this was first presented to us as a potential topic of discussion on Central Coast Voices, I was somewhat stopped in my tracks, for lack of a better way of putting it, because indeed what we are talking about is a method of building small homes in San Luis Obispo for a project that is underway with buildings that are made by what we would think of as conventional 3D printing. Yes, it's on a larger scale than whatever you may have for a 3D printer on your desk or in your workplace or even as a project device. But Azure Printed Homes is an innovative company that the city and county of San Luis Obispo stumbled upon, for lack of a better way of putting it, of a way to build homes. My guest today is Margaret Shepherd Moore, and she is the project manager for Welcome Home Village, and we'll explain what Welcome Home Village specifically is in a little bit. And Ross McGuire, who is the CEO and co-founder of Azure Printed Homes. This is a radio program, and I have to say that there are times, especially like today, when I regret that we don't have the ability to just give you a visual sighting of what we're talking about too, but we'll share with you how you can find out some more information. But yes, we are talking about the ability to manufacture homes to be available for homeless members of the community that need housing in a way that is remarkably less expensive, remarkably durable, and involves for every housing unit approximately 150,000 recycled plastic bottles to build them. This, when I started putting my notes together for this, the ability to decide how we start this topic and how we tie it together was very difficult to address. Before we do that, let me remind you again that you are welcome to give us a call at 781-3875. That's 805-781-3875. And be part of this discussion. But it's fascinating. And Ross, I think we're going to start with you because my hunch is the average listener to the program today knows a lot about the homeless crisis in our county and things that are going on to do it. So Margaret's perspective on this as project manager for Welcome Home Village, we'll get to in a little while. But I suspect as we did the intro to the program and or people who looked at the intro for the program that was on the website, their reaction was, what in the world is a home made by laser or by 3D printing? Ross, welcome to the program. Give us some idea. How do we explain to people who've never seen or heard this before what in the world a 3D printed home is?
Thank you, Fred. Yeah, I mean, to try and give a layman's term explanation. I mean, if you picture just a regular print, you're laying down ink onto a piece of paper. All we're doing in a 3D basis is laying print material down layer by layer to generate a 3D print size. So with
with our material and the scale that we go out.
Ross, I'm going to stop you a second, Ross. If you shifted your phone off of either voice or to speaker or vice versa.
Sorry. Yeah, I've dropped off. My headphone has dropped off. Sorry, I've tucked myself into a quiet corner within the factory. But yeah, can you hear me well now?
We can hear you now. That's fine. Thank you.
Okay, great. Apologies for that. The difference being with our system is that on a larger scale, we're laying layer by layer of material down to create the pre-designed models that we have. So we're only really limited by the build volume that we're able to achieve on our printers, which is around a 20 by 10 foot high build volume. And as you mentioned, you can kind of see on our website and other means online of how we approach it, but we essentially have a rotating table and a robotic arm with an extruder mounted to it, which allows us to create kind of large modules without having to have a huge printer to do it. And all of our printing is in factory, so there has been construction methods with 3D printing in the past and currently, which are mainly concrete based and mainly site based. Ours differs in that we're trying to be as economical and environmentally thinking as we can by using a waste material as our predominant part of our material for printing. So as you mentioned, we use a large amount of plastic waste. We also use fiberglass and other additives into the mixture. But in comparison to other 3D printed construction projects, we're based in the factory, so we do everything in a controlled environment rather than moving a printer from location to location to create the designs that are more regularly seen on site locations.
The footprint, I'm assuming that this is can be done as a series of modules or as individuals. What is the largest square footage that you're doing as one single structure?
So our single module size is we have for this project that we're talking about today in San Luis Obispo, we're doing two different sizes. We're doing one that's 100 square feet and another one that's 180 square feet. Because we are modular, we're able to connect those modules once we deliver them to site. We do everything what we call volumetrically, so we'll do all of the bathroom, the kitchen, all the interior finishes are done in the factory so that a finished unit is being delivered to site and connected to its adjacent module on site. So it just really brings down the whole site time cost and hours afforded to site assembly and site building considerably down. Home supportive housing is kind of one sector of what we provide. We also have ADUs, homes, and lots of other products and projects that we create as well.
My understanding is that one of the benefits of this process for, let's say, what we would refer to as a grandparent flat on someone's property is that it's easier and less expensive for you to do the foundation work for one of these than for a conventional home.
Yes. We can land our modules onto a multitude of different foundations. For the fact that we print the floor itself as well, it means that a concrete slab is not necessary. We would normally have a stem wall foundation, which creates a crawl space under the unit. One of the unique things that we initially suggested to Margaret and her team at San Luis Obispo County was to use a ground screw foundation, which we're proceeding with. So essentially exactly what you can picture in a regular screw. It's just extremely oversized, usually about 7 feet long and about 4 inches in diameter, drilled into the earth, usually at least kind of 2 feet into bedrock, and then our units are fixed directly to the top of that ground screw. So for the project in San Luis Obispo, we have around 450 ground screws that are going to be going in to support 62 of our modules. But the benefit from our perspective is that the install time for 450 ground screws is around 2 weeks. And they're obviously a better option than, say, pouring huge numbers of cubic yards of concrete as a foundation. And also, if for whatever reason in the future there was a need for the units to be relocated, the modules can be lifted, the ground screws can be unscrewed and reused elsewhere, and your land is pretty much back to the way that it was before anything arrived. So it's sustainable from that perspective as well.
It's fascinating. I want to mention to our listeners that that if you want to do a little further research on this, if you Google Azure Printed Homes, A-Z-U-R-E, on the TED Talk page, you can listen to a program, a TED Talk presentation done by you, by Gene, who is Ross's co-founder of this project, and there's also some good video on there of the printer actually working. It is just fascinating. Ross, we'll get back to you in a little bit. I want to have Margaret step in here, and because the question I'm sure most people have, because it's the question I had when I first heard about this, was how did this project come about, number one? Mm-hmm. But before we maybe work backwards from that, how in the world did the concept of doing this as 3D printed homes come up on the radar of the county and the city of San Luis Obispo enough to proceed? Because my first hunch would probably be, and I'm not a negative skeptic, would be this sounds too strange to be practical. What do we do?
Yeah, so it's an interesting story how we ended up with Azure, but I'll get to that. So thank you for having me here today, Fred. I'm the project manager, as you mentioned, for the Welcome Home Village, and I've been with the project since October of last year. But this project dates back to 2023 when the county received a grant for from the state of California, and it's what it's called as an Encampment Resolution Fund, an ERF grant. And our encampment that we set out to address is the Bob Jones Bike Trail. And I'm sure you're familiar with that. It's not too far here from the station. And so this village is to address the encampments that are along the Bob Jones Bike Trail. But within those, you know, from 2023 up until late into 2024, we had encountered some challenges. Like the village was originally going to be over by social services and then needed to find a new location. And we settled on the location, which I think is a brilliant location, which is on the corner of Johnson and Bishop, right over by drug and alcohol services, behavioral health, probation's up the hill. We have a sobering center, a hospital, like a lot of different facilities right around that location. So when I came on board in October, we had settled on this location. The project had decreased in size because the location is a parking lot on a grade. And when you have a hill you have to deal with, means you know, have to dig into it. You've got to, there's a lot more that goes into prepping a site on a hill. So we were working with Dignity Moves, and they had a couple of different builders that they had presented to us. And the budget was so tight with the cost of construction for these units that we had gone from 80 units down to, at that point, 34 units. And no space for a community room, a half a community room with a laundry room in the same room, and no office space. And I was just looking at these plans, and it wasn't sparking joy, needless to say. But There was Dignity Moves, who we have contracted with to help facilitate this process from the beginning. On this Excel sheet that they had with the different pricing for the different companies, there was a tab that had Azure Printed Homes on it. And I'm not sure if an intern put that on there or how it got there, but I was curious about these Azure Printed Homes because the pricing seemed more in line with what we could afford. And then I looked them up online and thought, that can't be possible. How is it that these beautiful units cost less than these T111-sided units that we were going to have to go, that we were originally looking at? So I started doing my due diligence, Google searching, looking, you know, at all the different videos of, you know, Ross had put out there, that Gene had put out there, and then I found, then I found Ross's phone number online, and I called him out of the blue, and I just said, hey, I'm calling from San Luis Obispo, we have this project, and we just started a discussion, and Ross, I really jived with him from the beginning, because he wasn't just about printing the units. He was into approaching the entire site. So we have a hill. And how can we address that? Well, with ground screws and a decking system. And so he was seeing the project in a holistic way, which was great. So Dignity Moves vetted them as a builder because they hadn't used them.
Interject. We probably need to explain to folks who Dignity Moves is.
Okay. So Dignity Moves is a nonprofit company that works with counties throughout California to help them build these tiny home villages, interim housing villages throughout California. And they help counties with through the process of finding the homes and helping to find the location for them. I wasn't there when they first came on board, but they were there since the inception to help us kind of just vet who we should use. And, you know, as a homeless services division, we are not a planning and building department. We are not public works. So they're there to help assist, you know, departments like ours with counties to make things like this.
And I will say, with my own research, they have an incredible reputation for how they look at projects that are unusual and different and mm-hmm. challenging, and a way to bring them about.
Yeah.
I mean, they're a wonderful partner to work with.
Yeah, they're very innovative, and they've been building a lot of these communities throughout California, but they hadn't used Azure Printed Homes on this scale previously. And I'm not sure if it's because the counties that they're working with were more risk adverse. But once we started talking with Ross, Ross was vetted by Dignity Moves. You know, my supervisors and leadership at the county were on board with it. They were willing to give this a shot. And here we are today. Tomorrow we are starting demolition on the parking lot, which is just a huge milestone. So we're super excited. But with Azure Printed Homes, now we have 54 units. We have a full community room. We have a laundry room. We have offices for therapy for substance use disorders and mental health. We just have a dog run. This community is going to be really all-encompassing and whole person care oriented. And Azure Printed Homes is making that possible. Meanwhile, we are also saving 6.4 million water bottles from ending up in landfills. So it's just a win all around.
I want to reiterate that number. 6.4 million plastic water bottles mm-hmm. that historically either end up in the landfill or, God forbid, the ocean, to build these homes.
Yeah. I mean, that's huge. And I know that the city of San Luis Obispo, they were excited about that too, because they have a lot of sustainability efforts and they're really focused on that. So they were happy that Azure provided, you know, 60% of their building material being durable recycled plastics. But also the units being built in a factory down in Gardenia, we don't have to worry about the weather. Sometimes we've had months and months of, you know, nonstop rain, whereas these units are going to be in a factory printed and then brought up here once they're complete. And like Ross was saying, that they'll be, you know, joined together and all of those processes. But we won't have to worry about the rains happening, or if Ross could go more into the building materials, but they have the finite, you know, they know the quantity of building materials they'll need, so we don't have excess. So it's kind of just a cherry on top of the sundae that this is environmentally conscious, but then also it fit within the budget that we had, and so that we could have the all 54 units.
Yeah. Ross, I want to get back to you for a moment. I suspect that the amount of skepticism your methods have is truly based upon people just being kind of shocked and amazed that this is a viable alternative when it's so different than the way we expect things to be made. And for lack of a better word, I'm sure you have people who kind of perceive, oh, this is a Lego block home. It's a toy as opposed to a serious building method. Do you have to address that often?
I mean, I've been in construction my entire life, all the way back from growing up and living in the UK, and did my master's degree there in civil engineering, and worked in some really high profile jobs there. That I approach this whole thing from the fact that, being an engineer, I just obviously love to problem solve, and being frustrated by how long things take, seeing dumpsters of waste like leaving job sites that you're on a daily basis, and at the same moment just see new materials arrive all packaged and ready to be cut in half and follow the same circular effect of waste. And cost, like, I guess I'm one of those people that just I can't get my head around sometimes how much particularly home building and construction cost. That it was a pretty simple and easy equation and fit for me, because it means taking something that we abundantly can't find a new home for, and we're burying because we have no other use for it in landfill, and finding a perfect use for it in something that we have a shortage of, a crisis in for housing. So it for me made perfect sense from the very early concept of the idea. But you're right. I mean, there's certainly some trepidation about whether the solution is a fit. But I mean, we have been delivering these for the last 3-4 years. We've gone through excessive testing, and with it through durability, UV testing, temperature cycling testing, where it goes through 2,000 hours of being under UV light to 2,000 hours of raising our print material to 180 degrees Fahrenheit, soaked in water, then dropped to minus 30 and repeated over a 2,000 hour period. So we have been able to prove out all of the concerns from those perspectives. But yeah, sure. I mean, it's particularly with factory building as well. Factory building has a certain negative connotation with it as well, where obviously subpar options for building homes have been generated in factories in the past. But I mean, I have only ever seen it as a positive, having come from building much more conventionally on traditional building sites and relying on people to get to those sites on a daily basis. Otherwise, it affects your timelines, it affects your budgets, it affects your quality when you're scratching for the correctly skilled people to carry out necessary tasks. There's so much more control in all of the aspects of construction when it comes to timeline, budget, quality, and environmental effect when you're producing something in the factory. And as kind of Margaret and the team have experienced as we've gone along as well, it's not as if we have one product that we can produce, obviously being factory-based and wanting to have the efficiencies of building in factory and producing in factory, we want to be as efficient as we can, but we try and keep the on-the-floor process as efficient and as repeatable and standardized as we can by having a huge amount of engineering and design and planning work in the weeks and months preceding a project being ready for manufacture. So, I think I lost the actual question through that.
That's fine. Your answer is delightful to listen to, truly. As you're speaking, and from Margaret's discussion of how many water bottles this project is going to use up, because this is a recyclable product that is not being effectively used in a lot of industries, my hunch is that the storehousing of these kind of recyclable materials is not something that anyone is standing in line for the opportunity for. If this becomes successful enough, is there a concern about not running out of supplies available, of supplies that exist, but running out of places in which the recycling industry is adequately channeling these materials for you to get them?
Yeah, I mean, I think the U.S. Is certainly becoming more efficient on that side. I know that statistically, I think it's around 40 million tons of plastic go into our effectively our recycling trash cans on an annual basis, and only around 6% of that actually gets recycled. I mean, until I kind of dug in and researched that for myself, I didn't necessarily realize that was the case. You think that just because you're putting it into your blue bin as it is at my house, that you assume that means it's got a second life ahead of it. But it certainly hasn't been the case over the last decades. I mean, the use of plastic has obviously shot up since the kind of 60s and 70s, but the interest in that statistic and the interest in knowing that it can be easily recycled and reused, I think, is meaning that there are a lot more people in the market for concentrating on the filtering and mechanical recycling that is possible with a lot of the plastics that we're all dealing with on a daily basis. Yeah. So
My hunch is that a lot of what you're at least benefiting
and reducing that is just going to increase.
Yeah, I think a lot of what you may be dealing with, which I suspect is a positive to this, is that it's not heavy, and it may be when it's been refined down to be used as in your printing process, it may weigh a lot more than we're used to. But this is a rather lightweight commodity, so.
And when it has been broken down mechanically, then you're dealing with pellets and flakes, so it's all very densely compacted, so to speak. So when you're looking at thousands of water bottles and plastic waste, and once it's been processed, then it's not as significant as it necessarily sounds in volume.
Yeah. We're going to take a brief break, folks, and remind you again, the phone number you can call in and be part of this discussion is 805-781-3875. If you have some questions or thoughts about this process and how beneficial it is, and maybe you have had some experience with other places that this kind of material and project is being used, and or if you have some questions and some observations about how Welcome Home Village is going to fit into the ongoing community efforts to limit the homeless population that's still on the streets. Give us a call at 805-781-3875. We're going to go back to Brad for a moment. We'll take a minute or so break, give everybody a chance to to stretch, and we'll be back with you in a minute and a half or so.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA, a conversation with Late Show with Stephen Colbert comedy writer Felipe Torres Medina about his new book.
For me, as a comedian, there is an element of having to face the horrors with humor because it's the only way we can endure it.
That's next time on Latino USA.
On the next Fresh Air, from cartel kingpins to cosmic battles to the end of the world, Pedro Pascal has faced them all on screen. This summer, Pascal stars in the Fantastic Four, First Steps, Eddington, and The Materialists, and he's also up for an Emmy for The Last of Us. His other TV shows include The Mandalorian, Narcos, and Game of Thrones. Join us.
Job applications are getting a little unhuman.
The experience that we put these job seekers through, right? Being interviewed by a robot, essentially. I think it's kind of a violation of basic dignity.
I'm Kai Rizdal, Mission Impossible, The Job Market, next time on Marketplace.
President Trump loves to make a deal. Can he make one with Vladimir Putin for a ceasefire in Ukraine? And can it happen without Ukraine at the table?
To the good, for the good of Ukraine. Good stuff, not bad stuff. Also, some bad stuff.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Our team will be on the ground in Alaska for the summit on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
That's a look ahead on our Thursday here on KCBX. It's Fresh Air coming up from 3 to 4 after we listen to Latino USA. Then it's Marketplace from 4 to 4:30, followed by All Things Considered from 4:30 to 6:30. Right now, let's return to Fred Monroe and his guests on Central Coast Voices. Back to you, Fred.
Thank you, Brad. Glad to be with you. If you're just joining us, we are talking about an interesting project which is called Welcome Home Village, and we'll explain that in a little bit. My guest from Welcome Home Village is Margaret Shepherd Moore. She's the project manager for the County of San Luis Obispo in this project. And with us by phone is Ross McGuire. He is the CEO and co-founder of an organization called Azure Printed Homes. It is 3D printing of structures that become, for lack of a better word, small homes that in this case with the Welcome Home Village is a more permanent version of housing available for those people who are currently homeless in our community. And yes, you've heard us correctly. We are talking about 3D printed homes. And Ross is joining us as part of the discussion. Ross, while I think about it, because I'm sure it's a question that's come up for some of our listeners. Is there an established understanding of what the life of these structures are? I mean, there are wooden structures with wooden siding, not counting concrete and things like that, that are the size of what you're dealing with that are maybe 80 to 100 years old. I suspect this process has not been around for 80 to 100 years to actually have a good, clear timeline. But what is your experience with that question?
I mean, particularly when we're talking about plastic, it's famously hard to degrade. So added to that, we don't have the concerns that we do with traditional wood framing of it being affected by moisture or water and rotting, or by termites and other pests and being eaten away at. The biggest thing that we have to be cognizant of is the degradation due to the sun mainly. So two of the things that we do as part of our process is include a UV stabilizer within our print composition, as well as applying a UV coating over the prints once they're finished as well. The provider of that UV coating gives us warranty of 20-year coverage of protection from UV. From that one coating that we apply. So it's really no different to any other home in that you would just need to repaint, recoat the home every 20 years just to maintain that that coverage of protection.
Yeah, my thought is, if it's a wood frame structure, it needs a decent paint job in less than 20 years too. Yeah, Brad, did you have something?
Yeah, I did. We had a caller, Matt in Santa Barbara, who is a regular listener of Central Coast Voices, wanted to make sure that we pass that along. He really enjoys the program.
Well, thank you.
He did talk about the viability of this process, but he did express, are there any concerns about the effect of microplastics with this process, and how, you know, if you're living in them, is there a process to help manage that in the building process and long term?
Yeah, I mean, we've done a lot of testing ourselves, and we generally provide air quality monitors inside each of the units as well. But the composition that we use is entirely non-toxic. Obviously, we have more risk from putting out food and drink and consuming it from directly from these containers than we do from necessarily having it as a surface. Really, like, plastics become microplastics mainly from abrasion, which, as you step into one of our units, you wouldn't necessarily know that it's been the shell has been printed, because everything on the interior is more traditional in its construction. And the other way that plastics become airborne is more through kind of off-gassing. So if some plastics are very sensitive to temperature changes, so if it gets too high in temperature, then some polymers are likely to off-gas, but we, again, have tested ours at very high temperatures to know that it is stable enough not to off-gas in those scenarios. So, yeah, that is a common question for the use that we're finding for polymers. So it's something that we've considered from the very beginning to ensure that it's safe to use.
I hope that answers Matt's question. Want to say thank to him for providing it and listening to us in Santa Barbara.
Great. Yeah, thank you, Matt. And for others, if you'd still like to call in, 805-781-3875. Brad, on the last caller, has now reminded me of something I didn't mention, which is, if you don't want to be on the air but you want to share the some information with us or some questions, let us know. Ross, you may not have lived in the United States when this came about, and I'm not quite sure how long it's been gone, but as we're talking about this, and I remember looking online at some pictures of the structures that you have done already, what comes to mind is that in the late 50s, early 60s, when Disneyland was first built, there was a Home of the Future that was a product of Monsanto, never became a successful housing method, but was rather attractive and innovative looking. And the pictures I've seen of the homes that you've done, and I would classify some of them as kind of like cabins or getaway places, more than not just large residences, reminded me of that. It's a very attractive material, and the way in which you're using it is very attractive. And one of the concerns that I thought about as we've been talking about this, that Margaret may have thought about in her rest of her staff, is that we may end up with a lot of people from other areas of the county or other areas of the state or the nation that want to come see these. And so we need to make sure that this project is done in a way that that gives the residents their adequate privacy, even though it's something that sharing with others may be very helpful with.
It's true.
Yeah. Fred, we've got another call-in question, and she didn't want to be on the air, but she did want me to pass the question along.
Okay.
Linda, who's out in Creston, as you know, kind of in the thick of the fire zone right now. And her question was about fire. What kind of protection or what kind of effect would fire have on these structures? And, you know, is this a practical thing for people to use if they are in a fire-prone zone?
Ross, what do you think?
Particularly for this project in San Luis Obispo, we've followed the guidance of and complied with the guidance for the development, which means that in most scenarios we have around 10-foot spacing between modules in between each of the boundaries to the exterior. And we have we apply a fire retardant into the print mixture, as well as that prior to that UV coating, we also put a Class A fire coating on it as well, which certainly avoids it becoming a an ignition source. But I mean, we've seen it here, obviously, with the homes lost in the Palisades and in Altadena, and we have a number of customers right now that we're in the process of rebuilding, or at least planning to rebuild through our methods as well. So, we're in high compliance with what is necessary, and always looking to try and add more and more resistance, particularly where we are in California, knowing that it's not something that's going to be going away any year soon, and obviously as the fire maps and risk and or perceived risk, especially as the fires are moving into more and more areas that were previously assumed safe, we're obviously very conscious of making our product as fire conscious as it can be.
Thank you. Good information. Margaret, so the overall, the construction hasn't really started yet. Mm-hmm. You're in some demolition process. What is the timeline that you're working with?
Actually, can I just touch on what Ross was talking
about? Go right
about
ahead,
the,
yes.
The fire safety. And Ross would know more about this, but as I've just been watching the fires as they've been the Gifford fire going, and the, of course the Palisades and Eaton fires, but these units, I know that a lot of times that embers will fall on roofs, and I don't know what specifically, because Ross knows, he's the expert, but as far as the roofing materials for these, they're not traditional roof tiles, so I think that might be helpful. But in this village, we actually are doing we're having every unit is sprinklered. So that's what part of our fire safety for the village is, we actually have all of the units have sprinkler systems installed in them, everything down to the laundry rooms and the bathrooms. So going back to your question,
as you talk about this, about the sprinkler system, based upon the material involved and having a sprinkler system, mm-hmm. My thought is there may be an added benefit that we haven't discussed, which is you're talking about a material that is not in and of itself flammable. So if there should be a kitchen fire, a bedroom fire, your ability to, with sprinklers, possibly still save the structure once the fire's out, it's something I hope we don't have to test.
Yes.
But my hunch is that it may have some good benefit.
Yeah. That's our hope, too. Even with the decking that we're installing, that was another one of Ross's ideas, is instead of having wood decking, there are these really cool platforms that Ross could probably describe them pretty well. I have some pictures that I can't show on radio, darn it. But they're tile. They're porcelain tiles. The decking systems are all on these pedestals that you can move up and down and make different heights. So we're having three different levels of decking, so that from the high end of the property down to the low end, all handicap accessible, but it's not wood. So it's not going to – that's not going to catch fire and be a big mess. So I thought that was great that when Ross talked about the decking system, you know, wood sounded a little iffy, especially within that location. We've had a couple of fires just right up on the hill up there behind the old General Hospital. But with that decking system and then with the units, I think our risk of fire is pretty low.
Okay. So the question that we got away from back in what? Yeah. the timeline we're working on.
Yes, the timeline. So the timeline was so tomorrow, which was exciting. I was doing a happy dance in my cubicle to let cool in the gang. Tomorrow we are starting demolition on the parking lot, and we will need to update the construction schedule because there have been a couple of weeks of delays just with the final, you know, I's dotted and T's crossed with the permitting process. But our hope is to have the village ready for residents at the end of February of 26. And it might move a bit into March, just, you know, being as construction is. But it is helpful to know that we don't have to worry about the weather as much.
So we're talking about barely 6 months from now, going from demolishing parking lot to habitable.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't happen very often in the real world.
It doesn't.
And I'm in concrete and stick and nails construction.
Mm-hmm. Well, because I mean, Ross can start printing the units as they're doing the site work, so those can go on in tandem.
Monday.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, say again, Ross.
We start on Monday, so I mean, it's traditionally you would have to go through demolition, groundwork, utilities before you can then even start building anything above ground on site. But the beauty of this process is that whilst all of the demolition, utilities, groundwork and foundations are going on, we're actually being productive simultaneously in the factory so that everything just gets condensed down to a much shorter duration than traditional means.
You missed Margaret's happy dance when you said that. It is seldom we get to talk about a positive project in the community that has got so many, I guess, subcategories of beneficial parts of the process here. And I can't wait to see this. Again, one of my big concerns is whether or not once these are habitable and they have residents in them, how we keep the looky-loos and the other organizations and other counties from kind of, you know, are we going to have to schedule tours with the public so they can understand how this is? My hope is that the progression of putting units in is such that maybe before the project is completed, the ability for the county to arrange some individual tours for people to understand what this process is. I'm sure, Ross, that won't it may get in your way a little bit in some of the work you're doing, but it certainly will be beneficial for more people to understand this. There are very few projects that I consider as mutually beneficial as what you have proposed here.
No, appreciate it. Yeah, I mean, we would certainly encourage people to come visit and learn more. I mean, it's ironic you say that because, I mean, one of the earlier conversations I had with Margaret was like, we don't want to make this a place or development that people are intimidated by or walking by kind of with any kind of ill feeling. So there was a lot of focus that we had on making sure the landscaping and other aspects made the feel and the environment, not just from the inside for the residents, but also from the outside of the neighbors, making it feeling very, very friendly and inviting. But yeah, I hadn't considered that there might necessarily be tours needing to be organized for neighbors and community as well. But I'm glad we're talking in that direction rather than the alternative. So that's great.
There may be a fundraising opportunity for further projects by charging admission to the tours before the project is finished.
Before the residents move in.
But it's as I said, there have been very few topics that we've had on this program that appear to have so much level of mutual benefit for need in the community that that gets us to a positive place. The topic, one of the things that we didn't really talk about was some of the misconceptions that people might have. And I think we may have covered them, but we didn't specifically emphasize them. These are not temporary structures. On the list of things that we think people may have thought that this was about, these are not tough sheds like you buy at the housing materials store and drop in for a storeroom. This is real permanent housing, which brings up another quick question in my mind, and that is, when you deliver the modules to the site, have you already installed most of the plumbing and any kind of kitchen items that need to be in them? So that gets you further along the process. You can be working on that if there's a rain problem on the site. Those are things you can be doing back at the factory.
Right. Yeah. No. We do that as standard. So each unit leaves with kitchen, bathroom, all the interior finishes, floor, ceiling, walls, painted, decorated. Everything is ready to move into when it leaves the factory. We just leave what we call stub outs for the plumbing to connect to, open conduits for the live electrical cables to connect to the panels for each unit. So fundamentally, other than for kind of testing and commissioning, that the air conditioning is working, all the plumbing is working, all the utilities are working inside the unit, there's not necessarily a need to step inside the unit once they've been delivered, because of all that being done in advance. It certainly means that everything underneath the units can be placed in advance and ready, meaning all of the sewer, water, and electrical lines, so that it's just a straightforward connection once the modules are placed on top of those ground screws that we mentioned.
Yeah. As we do every program, in the last few minutes, I always want to give my guests the opportunity to kind of have the last word in what you would like our listeners to be able to be left with as far as their thoughts about this project. And yes, we will bug Margaret to make sure there are tours available at some point, and we'll let people know about that. Ross, let me start with you. What would you like folks to remember about this conversation and about this project?
I mean, it's been great to be part of your show, Fred. Initially, thank you for the invitation and for having us. I as Margaret kind of mentioned, this has turned into. I mean, I've had lots of passion projects. My whole business is a passion project, but this particularly turned into one pretty early on, knowing kind of the struggles that Margaret described, like in advance of our involvement in the project. And being able to offer some solutions that alleviated some of the hurdles that they were facing was great. But I mean, I kind of see this as a very simple and easy blueprint, so to speak, that can be repeated wherever it's needed, like taking a vacant parking lot and being able to spin it around into housing for 60 people within, or 54 people within a 6-month period is something that can be very easily repeated across different locations. So I see it as being we know, particularly in California, we've got just in LA County, we have over 75,000 homeless and obviously more across the state. So there is a simple and easy solution without a great deal of cost and time involved. So I want this to be kind of a legacy that can be an example to other locations across the state and the country as well.
Right. Thank you. Good point. Margaret, what are your thoughts that you want to make sure people are stay in the forefront of their thoughts about this project?
Oh, I think that the Welcome Home Village, once it's completed, will just show that we don't have to have really big apartments for people to move into, and that Yeah, I encourage people to go to the – it's hard to find it on the county website. So just Google Welcome Home Village SLO and reach out to us. We're going to be doing the Adopt-A-Room. We'll be posting stuff on there about that. But thank you so much, Fred, for having me. And thank you, Ross, for your amazing printed solution that's making this village possible.
Yeah. Back up, since we have a moment, a couple of just some questions to reiterate. How many units was the original project before you realized this method was available to build them?
Well, it went from 80. We had to cut it down to 34, but now we're back up to 54.
And the original cut was based upon the cost of doing the project.
Yeah, the cost of construction. Yeah.
Pretty amazing.
Yeah.
For those of you who have not been with us for the entire program, Margaret Shepherd Moore is the project manager for Welcome Home Village, a homeless transition or a housing project transitioning out of homelessness on Bishop and Johnson that we've been looking at and talking about with Ross McGuire, who is the CEO and co-founder of Azure Printed Homes, because they have found a way to use 3D printing to build structures which have made this project viable. And frankly, make the project viable at a remarkable reduction in cost, which means more units being able to be built. We in today's world, we seldom get the opportunity to see that kind of positive movement in a project. There's usually roadblocks that we aren't aware of, and mm-hmm. in this case, some of the roadblocks are gone because of this project. This has been Central Coast Voices. Chris Kington Barker will be with you next week and on the program. And I'll be back with you in about 4 weeks. And our other hosts, of course, will be here in rotation. I'm not quite sure what Chris has got on the table for next week, but she'll do a wonderful program for us. You can reach us at voices@kcbx.org. Email for feedback and questions you may have. Thanks to listener-supported public radio KCBX and our in-studio engineer Brad Kyle. My guests today have been Margaret Shepherd Moore and Ross McGuire. This has been Central Coast Voices. Thank you for joining us today.